We're going to be going into the Middle Ages. I've gotten for you a brief timeline that I'd like to carry over just a few different types of things. Some of these you'll recognize, some of these may be a little bit not too familiar with. We're going to learn as you look just prior to 500, and that's pretty much the timeline that we're going to go back to. We really start the Middle Ages right here about 600-590 with Gregory the Great. That pretty much, as we said last week, he is the quintessential Roman medieval pope. All right. Now, prior to that, a couple of things happened. We've got this guy named Clovis Baptism. Baptism is not his last name. He is going to be a ruler, and we'll talk about him a little bit later on. We've got, as we looked at, Patrick, which is just prior to that, although because of his missionary efforts in Ireland, led into the Middle Ages. So as we start just before 600 with Gregory the Great, you'll notice that several things are kind of culminating. We've got this young man named Augustine, who Gregory, Pope at Rome, sent to England. One of the great missionaries to reestablish and retake that. We'll talk about him in a minute. We're going to just very briefly touch on this gentleman named Mohammed, born just before 600, about 20 years before 600, and lived and died right about that time frame, and the Islamic advance into the Eastern Roman Empire. You'll notice from the beginning we've kind of labeled this early part of the Middle Ages the Christianization of Europe. I'd like to put a little C, Christianization, on that, because that's going to be one of the things that we're going to see, that the history of the church really starts to change its definition about what Christianity is. We've got a battle there. You would think in a church Sunday school we're not going to talk about battles, but that's going to be, quite frankly, a very significant thing. And then we've got a missionary to Germany named Boniface in the middle of the 8th century, and then we're going to culminate this early Middle Ages timeline with the coronation of Charlemagne. And he is going to now change what you would refer to, and most people refer to, as the Dark Ages. A lot of people think that the Middle Ages are the Dark Ages, but truly, with the fall of Rome and the fall of enlightened thinking and the fall of education and all those other kinds of things, Europe was pretty dark at this time. And so that's where that phrase is going to come from.
Next.
Yes, sir.
Great centers of learning, like Athanasius,
Alexandria, the School of Alexandria.
The libraries and everything were destroyed.
Correct. Yeah, we're talking about the final, generally people talk about the fall of Rome at 576. All right, that is the last time. Now, you'll recall, I think, from a couple of lessons ago, we saw that we had the Visigoths who came in, and they sacked Rome. Actually didn't really sack that. They pretty much just simply took it over. It was the Vandals that Leo the Great, and again, this is back in the late 400s, Leo the Great says, please, please, please don't burn our city to the ground. And they said, okay, we won't. Now, the Vandals had come around from all the way through Spain, through northern Africa to Carthage, and that was the one that Augustine, literally it was the Vandals which were attacking Hippo and Carthage. They were laying siege to the city when Augustine went to bed and died. I mean, right during that siege. And it was that time period that they came in and destroyed a lot of the learning. That's why it was so important, as Richard pointed out two or three weeks ago, that the monks in the monasteries of Ireland as Jackson said, the book written about 10 years ago saved civilization because it was there continually, mundanely copying. From a Protestant point of view, we look at the monasteries and we say, boo, evil, you know, God never told us to leave the world and go and just live our own private little lives. But yet, providentially, it was those monasteries during this time period that God used to be able to save much of the civilization that then was the foundation for what Luther found 1,000 years later. So, these are very, very interesting times. You know, he's going to use this character Muhammad, you know, and all of the things that go along with him. In fact, next week, Darren is going to give us some great insight. And I'm going to touch on him today, but just very, very briefly. All right, let's just review. We already talked about Augustine, whom Gregory the Great, again, Gregory the Great, the kind of the beginning pope of the medieval time, sends Augustine to Angleland, the land of the Angles. A little bit later on, as the Saxons come over from Europe and they invade, they intermingle with the Angles to form none other than the Angles and the Saxon. The Anglo-Saxon then starts mixing together. And so Gregory the Great sends Augustine, this is not the Saint North Africa Augustine, but this is a missionary to, it's just different, you know, same name. All right. Just like when we get to the Crusades, Benjamin Franklin is going to be teaching us, not the Benjamin Franklin that flew the kite 200 years ago. All right. And so Gregory the Great's point was to regain the country for Christ. Now, you recall that the Romans had ruled over England, or what we now call England. And they had that rule there. When the Romans pulled out, then both the pagans and the invaders came over. All right. We're going to also, again, we mentioned a missionary named Boniface. It was actually a German native guy. His name was Winfred, and he was rechristened Boniface by the Pope. Again, this is about the 8th century. He is going to go into Germany. Now, you recall last week we drew that map of all of Europe and saw that the great divide between the old Roman Empire and the barbaric lands to the north was kind of this Rhine-Danube river system that went all the way from the Netherlands all the way to the Black Sea. And it was a very clear divide that on the other side of the river were all of these evil, wicked, barbarian tribes. Boniface, or Winfred, went to a Germany. Then it was called Hessia. All right, some of you may remember from the American Revolutions that there were some people, some warring mercenaries who came and were, what were they called? They were called Hessians. All right, and that's where they were coming from. Well, there are all kinds of things that happened. He did not find any success, but one of the things that he did was he cut down this huge, huge, many thousand-year-old oak tree, and he cut it down. And the people said, "That's Thor's tree. You are fixing to get smacked." And they waited for the lightning to come and strike him dead, and it never happened. And so all of a sudden, these guys who had said, "We have been worshiping Thor, the god of thunder, for all these years," and lo and behold, the very oak tree that is so precious to him, he doesn't even care about. And then Boniface used that, again, to result in a number of conversions at that time. Incidentally, he, as a missionary, was actually killed later on. He was in his 70s. But he was killed as he had gone back to some of these areas revisiting. A bunch of pagans had fallen upon him and his party and killed them. One of the things that I'd like to remind us of is that We are going from a couple of different ways to understand becoming a Christian. The missionaries were coming out, and how did they preach to become believers in Jesus Christ? In much the same way as we understand the role of missionaries. They said, it is a matter of your personal relationship with the God of the universe through His Son, Jesus Christ. And so we were going to talk about, as I have said here, numbers of conversions. Conversion would still be an appropriate term. As we get to be a little bit later on, we're going to find, as we look at the Franks, now the Franks, again, most of these were Scandinavian and Polish, German tribes that are moving in this vacuum that Rome has left behind. The Franks are eventually going to go into what is what Julius Caesar referred to as Gaul, and certainly we are going to take that name and call it what we know of that area of the country, which is France. It comes from this Germanic tribe, the Franks. This ties in with our timeline that we've talked about earlier, and at the same time it ties in about this whole concept of becoming a Christian. The Franks were the first tribe to adopt Christianity in the Nicene Orthodox sense. You'll recall last week we talked about the missionary Ulfilas, who had been sent by none other than Eusebius of Nicomedia, who was an Arian. And so all of the conversions prior to this, the Gothic language, were all Arian conversions. Ones that had adopted that. Well, the Franks were the ones who actually adopted Nicene or Roman Catholic Christianity at this point in time. The ruler was a gentleman, a guy named Clovis, and Clovis was baptized. He had a conversion very similar to Constantine. He had a Christian wife, so this was nothing new to him. And so when he saw the same vision that Constantine saw, the cross in the under this sign, conquer, the cross in the sky, and so on, he then converted to Christianity, much the same as Constantine. If you want to debate about whether Constantine was a true believer or not, you can still make the same debate about Clovis. They had adopted this Christian faith, no longer the superstitious pagan faith of their forefathers. And he was baptized at the German town of Reims on the Christmas day of 496. Would have been a nice, chilly baptism because we had established December 25th as Christianity. Again, as we've said, we have adopted Orthodox Christianity. And here we come into the second, really, type of becoming a Christian that becomes prevalent now. We're going to actually see a third, as time permits, this morning when we get to Charlemagne that we're going to see. But this one says, if our king is a Christian, then that's good enough for us. That makes us Christians. All right? And so at that point, I'm probably even a little bit on thin ice just by just using a capital C Christian. From a capital C Christian point of view, we would not say that these people were born again. They were saved. But as their king becomes a Christian, so their tribe or nation a little bit later on becomes Christian from that standpoint. So this is now starting to be, again, as we mentioned last week, a moving away from the concept that the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter said, we are here to preach about faith in Jesus Christ. Now we're starting to become a lot of what we saw in Constantinople. It is going to become the national thing to do. Now, one of the things that the Franks and their adoption of Christianity is going to have is that this is going to have tremendous consequences. And we're going to see a little bit later on, for more than 200 years now, the Franks become one of the mainstays of Christian Europe. All right, I'm going to leave Europe for right now, and we're going to go because, as you'll recall, everything in the world has not taken place from Rome to the West. We still have the Eastern Church, what we will refer to as what? The Eastern Orthodox Church. You'll recall during this time frame, relationships are strained. They are not yet divided. They have not yet totally said, you go your way and we're going to go our way. That's not going to happen for another 300 or 400 or 500 years. In the Eastern Church, the Roman Empire is still in existence. Now, on the slide, we'll see that that is called the Byzantine Empire. Where do we get that name, Byzantine? Yeah, because the city that became the city of Constantine or Constantinople was Byzantium, and so you continue to see that. The Byzantium or the Byzantine Empire was never overrun by the Gothic Slavic movements of the barbarians to the south. Now, that doesn't mean it didn't try. It just simply means that they were able to successfully fend them off. Now, why would they be able to successfully fend them off when in Rome itself they couldn't? Well, the answer is, where was the emperor? He had moved from Rome to Constantinople. And in a sense, even though Rome was the historic city, the real power was there. It'd be almost like if we moved the capital of the United States from Washington, D.C. to Los Angeles. Some might make an argument we already have. But if we were to do that, we would still be talking about Washington, but all of the power and all of the things would gradually be moving there, and Washington would just be a shell of what it's formerly understood as. Now, they enjoyed relative peace, all right? They were able to fend off. There was no one coming from the south and the southeast, through Arabia and Turkey and so on, and so their defenses were right there at Constantinople. And Constantinople stood between the Eastern Empire and a lot of those invaders. In the end of the 5th century and into the middle of the 6th century, there was a Roman emperor named Justinian. Justinian provided over a real renaissance, a real resurgence within the eastern side of the empire. Economically, they really had a boom. Militarily, they had a blossoming. That was the great age of learning. One of the things those of you who are familiar with the scriptures and textual criticism know that this is the time frame that the Bible was redone and all of the Greek Bibles were kind of put together and formed the basis of what eventually became the Bibles, the Greek Bibles that got copied, to wit, all of the stuff that had been destroyed. And I think that's what Ben had talked about. All of the original manuscripts that got destroyed in Alexandria, all of the stuff that they got burned in Rome, both through the persecution and so on. It was Byzantium that had a lot of the scriptures. And as a result of which, that conglomeration is what we have inherited today as what is referred to eventually in the English Greek, which became the Textus Receptus, the received text. It was that Byzantine textual type. All right, during this time, Justinian sent some guys over, drove the Ostrogoths back out of Italy. He drove the Vandals back out of North Africa and kind of pushed them away, although once that they had been driven away, he pretty much retreated back into Constantinople and so on to be able to do that. But nevertheless, there was a pushing back of the barbarian invaders. He was said to be someone who is always at work. He was busy, busy, busy. as, in fact, he was referred to as the emperor that never sleeps. It was his building program that built a monstrous cathedral, which today is still in existence, all right, 1,500 years old. It was a Christian church at the time, and it's not today, but it's called the Hagia Sophia, all right, the Church of Sacred Wisdom, all right, in Constantinople. Now, what is it today? It is the mosque of Hagia Sophia because, you know, over the centuries, eventually it was Islam had taken by. But there's still a lot of the Eastern Orthodox things that is there. In fact, he is even considered to be a saint by the Eastern Orthodox Church. In two or three Sundays when Jackson is going to spend a whole Sunday talking about the Eastern Church, we're going to see that there is such an amalgamation of the rulers with the religious emphasis that we're going to see that their concept of being a saint, alright, is different than the Roman one. So Justinian is going to be a real important person. Now I have mentioned here on the slide in 568 there is a group called the Lombards. No sooner had Justinian driven the Goths out than about 15 years later there was another Germanic group that came in called the Lombards or the Longbeards. That's one of the things that we're going to see. In fact, in northern Italy, today, that area of Italy is called Lombardy because of this particular tribe which came through. The Po River Valley is going to be a very significant thing in Italian history throughout the years. Now, I mention that because all of these things, stay with me, because they're hopefully all going to be tying in together. And I mentioned this in the Eastern Church just simply because Justinian, who drove out the Ostrogoths, actually reconquered Rome itself as soon as he went back to Constantinople. It's like the scriptural concept, as you drive the demons out and leave a nice clean house, then what happens? You've only made room for others to come back in. All right. A major thing takes place in the Eastern Church during this early medieval time. And that is, there is a young man whose name is Mohammed. Mohammed is born about 570, lives not too old a life, dies about 632, and he is going to be the one who is going to have more of an impact on the Eastern Church than anyone else. So this is the time period that he is going to be. 622, he is going to go to his hometown of Mecca, start preaching his doctrine. Sorry, I was wanting to say something a little bit less flattering. But start preaching this new message that he had, and the people in his hometown said, "No, I don't think so. This is not good. You are all wet." And so he flees from Mecca in 622. You'll notice that that's only about 10 years before his death. All right, he flees from Mecca to a town north of that called Medina, in which he has a whole large amount of people who are eager for this. Again, we're going to do a whole lesson on this next week. All right. Anyway, after his death in 632, Islam, at his death, is pretty much spread to Arabia. The Romans never cared for Arabia. There were not any natural resources there. It's just a bunch of deserts. And so all these Bedouin, these wild horsemen, they were never any consequence to the Romans. But they'd spread pretty much to Arabia. And again, the great phrase of Islam, Allah is great and Muhammad is his prophet. That's about all I'm going to say about that, except that what I wanted to do was show you then some of the things that are taking place. Now, the area here of Arabia is all of this peninsula here, all the way up almost and right next door to the old biblical Edom. All right. Now, just so that we'll get a view of that, here is the area about 632, which is as far as Islam had spread. By the year 661, now we have pushed further and further out. Now this is only about 30 years. All right, all of these wild Arabian horsemen, they have pushed past Egypt here in Alexandria. They have gotten not quite, Carthage is right up there, so they have not quite gotten to Carthage. They are stopped right here in Asia Minor, pushed up to the Caucasus Mountains, and all the way over here through what is now current-day Iran. So here is Iraq with Baghdad. Here is Iran currently, and so now we are getting over into Pakistan or India as far to the east as Islam. And this is only within 30 years. All right, within the next several years now, we're going to go into northern Africa. We're going to go past Carthage and Hippo where Augustine was. We're going to go across the Strait of Gibraltar there and go all the way up into Spain. And actually, the year that we've got there on the map, 750, is actually going to be after they had continued to try and go up into, so here's the kingdom of the Franks up here, but they were going to try and go into this area. What had taken place is that there was a battle. Remember, we said that we were going to talk about a military battle. There was a battle at the place right there on the plain of Tours in 732, in which the Islamic invasion was stopped, and that's as far as they had gotten. And then after they were defeated at that battle, then they came back south of the Pyrenees Mountains right there, and that was then the Islamic encroachment into Europe from the west. All right. I'm sorry, was there a question?
Well, they went back into Spain?
Yes, back into Spain. The Pyrenees Mountains right there are that large mountain chain that separates Spain from the rest of Europe. And so now, by 732, we are at what we would call a stalemate. All right? We're going to see when we get into Charlemagne, hopefully this morning, but if not, next week or so, we're going to get past that. That's why all of this so you can see the Pyrenees Mountains there, and just south of that is as far as Islam is going to go. They become known as the Moors in Spain. And so that is as far as the Islamic push has done. But you'll recall, see, here is the Byzantine Empire. The Ostrogoths, remember, had gotten kicked out of Spain. They had taken over, Justinian had come in and taken over these islands, Sicily, little bits of Italy, and then all of the Greece and the peninsula there that Greece is on, up into Bosnia and so on, Croatia and Dalmatia, all of Asia Minor, and then here is Constantinople, right in the center, standing on the Bosphorus Straits. So, we now have seen that a lot has been taking place. Christianity is suffering, not Christianity as we understand it, but Christianity as the religion of the empire has now lost all of the lands. Look at some of the things. We have historical Jerusalem, where Christ lived, worked, and died. Syria up there, Damascus, where the Apostle Paul had been. All of the stuff that we had had, that great center of learning in Alexandria, is now dominated by Islam. Over here in Carthage and Hippo and all of the places that Augustine was, it is now under Islamic control. Now, here are the cities before we leave the map. Here's Mecca, right down here, which is Muhammad's birthplace. And then he made the famous flight that's celebrated today from Mecca to Medina, where he really sets up base and continues on.
It's always interesting to wonder why, how it's possible for Muhammad and his followers to, after he died, to conquer that much.
Well, Ben's question is a good question, is that how could these guys conquer all of that much? The answer is, and a lot of that has to do with the nature of the two religions. All right? How much military training do we do here at Dayspring? We don't do a whole lot. The message of Jesus Christ is what kind of a message? It is a message of peace. It is not a message of war. And so what took place is, let's go back to our map, really to answer this question. What took place is that there was a large amount of all of these Arabian horsemen who were warlike people that really said, we can really sink our teeth into this religion. This is speaking our language. Go out and kill the infidel. Go out. Now, what has Christianity done for now centuries in the Roman Empire? Well, from the old Roman point of view, it has made them soft. It has made them want to go into, where were all the people going if they really wanted to be godly Christians? Into monasteries. Retreat from society. Don't stand up to society. Now, a lot of these things, and I don't mind spending time because this is a good point, because what it's going to do is it's going to set the stage for what's going to happen in all of Europe, because there is going to be this constant battle for who is going to exert the power and who is going to have the religious side. All right? Is the Pope, as we get on through the Middle Ages and start talking about the Crusades, is the Pope responsible for putting together an army and going off and defeating Islam? Or are they responsible for building up the individuals and the poor and the person of Jesus Christ? And so these are going to be things that are set in a very great motion.
And I'm already reading about the Crusades, and you talk about setting stage for the Crusades.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. And these are going to be things. I mean, it was the Popes. Darren?
Yeah, one thing from a scripture militaristic perspective.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Uh-huh. Once that happened, there are these superior warriors. It's pretty easy to conquer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, interestingly enough, exactly what... It's exactly what Darren's point is, that as soon as Muhammad dies, Islam kind of stalls a little bit while they fight amongst themselves for a while. And then once that's settled, all of a sudden, because you'll notice that it took 30 years to get this far, and then pretty much they were able to go throughout there. In fact, we see a lot of the Sunni Shiite differences. They come from this time period. It was two people who wanted to succeed Muhammad, and one became the Sunnis and one became the Shia. And we still today to have those people who both of them believe that they're the true descendants of Muhammad. All right. Again, this was halted at, let's go on down. Remember, it was Clovis, the king of the Franks, who had accepted Christianity. All right. It became a nationalized Christianity. The Franks became the real staunch supporters of the Roman Church. And then, as these Islamic invaders are now coming through Spain and they're heading this way, there's a guy named Charles Martel. Martel means the hammer. And so Charles Martel, he's not the king, but he just happens to be one of the great generals of the time, raises up an army. He gets not only the Franks who are there in France, but also the Friscan nations, which are over across the Rhine River. They said, listen, guys, you know, I know we fight against each other. I know we don't have anything to do, but unless we join forces, we're getting ready to get overcome by this Islamic invasion that's heading our way. And so the Battle of Tours, then at 732, and what I've done is given you just a famous painting there. Here is a Charles Martel. It's a little dark. You can hardly see it. Right there in the center, and he's driving off the Muslim armies on this plain of Tours. You'll notice the symbology in the picture right there that this is the victory for Christianity against Islam. And again, the concept is that this is our nation against your nation, our religion against your religion, that is the great battle that's taking place. One of the things that took place is that these two went after each other for just a solid day, and then finally the day was over. They all marched back to their camps to recuperate for the night to start again on each other the next day. Charles Martel's armies got up the next day. They still had their vim. They said, okay, we're not going to give up. And they went back to the battlefield, and the Islamic horsemen were not there. They sent out parties searching for them. What had taken place? And what had happened is overnight, after they had disengaged, the army of Islam just had left all of their dead there and just simply retreated back beyond the Pyrenees Mountains and then stayed there in Spain. And so this was a great, great victory. The Franks had come in and they had saved the day. Remember that slide several slides ago that we said the conversion of Clovis, while it was just seemingly a barbarian chieftain who had accepted Christianity, they become the great defenders of the Roman Church. And so they are just tremendously, and we're only just begun with this relationship of the Franks with the church at Rome. Now, you'll recall that we talked about the Lombards as they had come in, the Germanic people had come in from Italy. They were, again, one of these Germanic tribes. They had accepted Christianity under the influence of Ulfilas years and years ago. And so we're seeing that the Lombards now are in Italy. One of the things that's taking place is that the Lombards were eventually won over to Nicene Orthodoxy as they had come in. Well, that was great news to the Pope at the time. His name was, actually, it was Gregory the First, who gladly says, you all are welcome to the fold. Even though you have come in, we are glad to see you here. We're going to crown you. I mean, you're in charge. No problem at all. Because what is the church looking for? It's looking for military guys. It's looking for people to defend. It's looking for sheriffs and county supervisors and all those kinds of things that they're looking for. And so Gregory the First puts the crown on the king, the Lombard king in northern Italy. Makes a peace with him. I've put a note in there. You'll notice that the crown he says, of course, was not just any crown. It is the iron crown because it has one of the three nails that were used on the cross. And so that's worked in there. Or, from our perspective, one of the 3,000 nails that were there on the cross. But it had a symbology. Now, there's a couple of things that are taking place, and we're going to amplify those in just as we continue on. The Lombards, however, never really had a good peace with the papacy. The papacy, now the Lombards there are in northern Italy, and down in Rome is the papacy, and there is this uncertain peace. There's constant friction between Constantinople and the papacy, so guess who the Pope can't call on to come and save them again? You know, it's the we're we're having disagreements, and so it's not really appropriate for us to ask the Eastern Roman Empire. So guess who the Pope starts to look to be his friend here against the Lombards? Well, the very one who is looking to, or eventually and a little bit later on, is going to be dispatching the Islamic invasion. And so we see now, we remember that the influence there, Charles the Hammer or Charles Martel, the battle, he now is going to start influencing the politics there in Italy. He is the bout. Now, his problem is he's not the king, remember? He's just a very powerful general who happened to be great at organization, who happened to be a wonderful leader, who raised the army to defeat the king. But all of the descendants of Clovis were kind of the not very militaristic descendants, and so they weren't a whole lot of leadership. And so now, when Charles dies, his son Pippin is now going to say, this is not going to work. I am a strong leader like my dad is, and I don't like it that we've got these lily-livered, wimpy kings, and here I am, the strong military guy. So Pepin overthrows, Kilderic is his name, and he assumes the throne of the Franks. Charles the Hammer, Charles Martel would not do that, but he is now dead, and his son Pepin assumes the throne. Who's the Pope looking for? He's looking for military, not political, but military help. And so what takes place is that we've got Pippin, who now has overthrown, made a coup to kick out the... He's looking for someone to say, you know, it would certainly be nice if I had the blessing of the church on my kingship. And so he looks to Rome, just as Rome is looking for some help. And so an alliance is verily made. Pope Zacharias heartily gives his approval. He says, hey, we're not here to take sides. If you're in charge, then you're the king. And so Pope Zacharias says it's only right for him who holds the power to be the king. And so the Pope gives Pepin his blessing. And then, of course, Pepin, he is anointed. This is in the year 751. This is just, again, this is about 20 years after the Battle of Tours. He is anointed. He is crowned. And guess what? One back has been scratched. So guess what? Even though, and here's the point I make up on the slide, the crowning of Pippin seems to be just a, sure, you're in charge, no problem at all. But it sets a precedence, what is almost probably the most insignificantly significant thing that happens, because who is doing what to whom? It is the Pope who is blessing the king. Who's in charge and who is the subservient? Well, it is the Pope who is doing the blessing. And so this becomes an extremely important event that's going to be referred to over and over and over. And whenever someone has not gotten that lesson, we're going to go right back to Pepin, as he is going to be the one. Now, Pepin and Zacharias, they don't have all of this in mind. They're not looking hundreds of years out to all of this power struggle between the church and the state, if you will. Now, what's happened is now the Pope has the right to bestow kingdoms. And, of course, if he can bestow a kingdom, he can take away a kingdom. And so now the theology that is going to plague the Middle Ages in this battle, and we're going to see, because this, we've just only just begun on this one. Augustine, remember his man, the city of God is greater than the city of man in Augustine's work? That's what's going to be referred to now. And so there's going to start this tremendous struggle between empire and papacy for almost the entirety of the Middle Ages. Of course, again, back to the one good turn deserves another. The Pope has now acknowledged that Pepin is the king of the Franks. And so what does he do? Well, he just decides to march his army into northern Italy and deal with these pesky Lombards who have been causing the Pope so much trouble. And he defeats, of course, the Lombard. Not totally, because that's going to take place. We're not going to be able to get to Charlemagne this morning, but we'll get pretty close. And so now, Pope Zacharias. Of course, the Lombards are defeated. What are they doing? They're the rulers of the land. And so what does Pepin do with his land that he has now conquered? He's not interested in this land south of the Alps. He is going back to France. So who should be standing there, smiling, saying, would you like someone to take care of these lands for you? Well, yes, Pope Zacharias, that would be wonderful. Could you take care of these lands while I go back and rule over the France or the Franks in their land? Well, certainly, and so Pope Zacharias becomes the ruler of the Papal States. And now the church is no longer just simply the spiritual authority. The church now has land that they must govern. They have these states of the church that they are responsible for. And so now, truly, as the title of the slide says, the Pope has become a temporal ruler. And so now that line between the city of God and the city of man is starting to be blurred even more. And we're going to see that that is going to continue on. By the way, this lasted for how long? Over a millennium. It was not until the end of the 19th century, that when the Kingdom of Italy was established, that the church no longer ruled over these papal states. Now we're going to stop there because this is going to be talking about the end of Pippin and his son Charles. And so we're going to start there and pick up there in a couple of weeks. We're going to go next week. We're going to talk about Islam. We're going to do a whole lot. I know a lot of you have some real serious questions about what is Islam about. Is it as much of a danger to us? Is it just a theological danger or what the situation is? And so Darren is going to get us informed on that. Then next week we'll pick up with Charlemagne and go forward from there. After which Jackson's going to come and talk to us about Eastern Orthodoxy. Ben's going to come and talk about the Crusades as we go through the coming medieval period. Very, very interesting as far as the development. Again, one of the things that we're doing is we're looking to see how God is working in ways that we don't expect, in ways that we do not understand. There is a lot that is going on. We would not be where we are today had God not raised up a guy whose birthday we celebrated last Thursday named George Washington. And had God not raised up some people doing secular things, but yet the Church of God is going to be strongly influenced. Let's pray. Our Father and our God, we are grateful to you that you work first of all and foremost of all in the very center of our beings, that you would help our minds and our spirits and our hearts be conformed to your image. Lord, as we hear Jackson preach this morning, I pray that you would help us to truly have our eyes turned on to you. But at the same time, Lord, we're thankful that you do not stop there, that you work in the circumstances around us, in our immediate circumstances, in the circumstances of our city and our state and our nation, in the circumstances of the world, that there is no place where you are not sovereign. There is no thing that takes place that is not something that honors you and works your will here on this earth. Help us, dear Lord God, to study of you, to learn of you, but with one purpose in mind, and that is to glorify you. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.